Okay, good. Whoa, this is a podcast. This is our second On the Road podcast for our listeners. I am at the original StackOverflow.com world headquarters, now demised, no longer, no longer world headquarters, the deprecated, also known as Jeff's house in El Cerrito, California.
Yes, filled with 2-year-old toddler stuff. I actually didn't know these guys were coming over, so it's not very clean.
We're not actually going to blame you for it.
We can blame Rock Hard Awesome. That's fine. But this is cool. This is the second time. Yeah, that's right. The last time we did this, Michael Pryor was here. I'll have to look up. I'll get in the show notes the actual podcast that was.
If anyone wants a long time ago. That was sort of an early episode. That was probably way before we were. It was before we were looking for to raise money for this company. And
yeah, it was a while ago.
I don't remember the context.
It was a while ago, but it's cool. We have all this equipment, and producer Alex is here.
Yes, and producer
on
Alex
on the wheels of steel.
So I don't have to like bust out the knapsack full of cables.
Yeah.
To put together a simple basic podcast.
That's right. But I thought we would open, Joel, with your question on Joel had some traffic concerns. Why don't you explain it, Joel?
Well, okay. So we've been wondering for a long time why, oddly enough, the traffic on ServerFault went down about 20%, but not really on any of the other sites. In fact, I don't even think it went down that much on SuperUser. Maybe a tiny bit, but not noticeable. But it was a real like sudden permanent drop in all traffic to ServerFault of about 20%. And naturally, of course, our suspicion always goes to the Google whenever this happens. You know, because a slight change in their page rank might cause you to receive suddenly an awful lot less traffic. And indeed, it is almost certainly because of Google sending us fewer links. So what we've been trying to figure out is what we did to offend the Goog, especially on ServerFault, as opposed to all the other sites. Like, why is ServerFault worse of all things? And my current theory of the week, we go through various different theories, and you're not allowed to ever know the answer. That's the trouble with Google. It has to be secret or it doesn't work. But my theory of the week was, I was reading this book called In the Plex, and In the Plex is sort of a history of Google, and it talks a little bit about some of their algorithms, and it talks about how Google looks at their logs, which show the searches that people are doing. And ever since the beginning of time at Google, they have had this concept that they measure called long clicks and short clicks. And a long click is a click from Google, or I guess it's actually an entry in the web logs, like an actual entry, because Google shows you some results, that is long, meaning you don't come back. There is no additional click for a long time. In other words, you don't come back to Google. They call it a long click because you've gone off-site and you just don't come back to Google. And a short click means you do another search very, very quickly after the first search. And so, in fact, according to this book, In the Plex, the way the spelling corrector works, where it says, you know, if you type Joel Splotsky and it says, did you mean Jeff Atwood? That's because of people instantly hitting back, going back to the Google search page and then changing the spelling of something in there. In their search terms, and then having a long click after that. So this, in the early days, I think this was considered an interesting behavior because in the early days, they just used it just to track the quality of their search results, which is if you search for something and you immediately come back to Google and search again for something similar, it's probably a sign that you weren't satisfied with the results that you got. So we thought that, you know, what I was thinking is very recently Google has had this thing called the Panda Update, mostly to try to get rid of the content farms and the demand medias and e-hows of the world that people consider to be crappy content. And so they must have looked for some kind of signal of quality of a site, something which a signal being an input to their ranking algorithm. And they must have, and my theory is that the signal that they're using is, you know, a disproportionate number of short clicks. So if a particular site, if Google sending you to a particular site causes you sort of disproportionately to come back to Google and either do another search or even just click off to another site, that might be an indicator to Google that that site is not so high quality, or at least you didn't find what you were looking for.
Right. And this is captured on webmasters.stackexchange. The question is 13920. And as with so many things, just a few ways to frame this discussion. First of all, because 90% of our traffic, roughly, it varies by site, but statistically 80 to 90% is a very safe number, comes from Google. Very small changes in the way Google works can affect us, I mean, heavily. I mean, that's just the nature of when you get most of your traffic from one source. When little things change, they can have a big effect on you. And I think the Panda update that Joel's talking about definitely, I was so on that because we saw the drop on server fault, and you know, I don't really like to look at traffic because to me it's like I just look at the site and I can tell if it's high quality. That's what matters.
That's all we want, right?
That's all I really care about. I don't really care like okay how many clicks we're getting, because I think if you have quality, then everything else comes, because quality is you know the important thing to have.
Eventually, it's Google's job to find the quality sites, not our job. Our job is to be a good quality site. And their job is to find the quality sites. And if they're not doing their job, then we just gotta wait for them to do their job. We can't.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. So I mean, to the extent that I'm a little ambivalent about it, because it kind of moves the focus from okay, are we quality, to like how do we satisfy this arbitrary algorithm, which is weird.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of like trying to get a high score in the SAT just because you want a high score, not because you actually care about learning anything.
Right.
That said, I mean, obviously this is still important, because as we become a venture capital founded company, obviously these numbers start to matter more than they used to.
They do like, look at that.
I'm sympathetic to the argument that we have to be a little bit more sensitive to this.
No,
stuff.
I don't. I'm with you. I don't actually care if we have high, but I do want to have high quality results. And to me, if Google is in some way telling us, or even if they're not telling us this, that for whatever reason people that come in on Google search results and land on server fault are less happy, you know, just 5% less happy, 10% less happy, or 20% less happy than the other sites. I kind of want to know why. I want to know, is that because we have the quality of answers on that site is slightly lower, or that the questions are just too hard, and so people, you know, in the domain of server fault, they're more likely to find us in a case where we just don't have an answer because the answer is just too detailed or too hard or too ambiguous. Because there are some things I think we could possibly address there, which we would want to do anyway, even if it had nothing to do with our traffic. Like one thing which I'm wondering about is, you know, we're still not sure what a good question is. We don't have good indicators ourselves of what a good question is, other than, I mean, you got page views, you got number of upvotes on answers, and a trailing third is number of upvotes on the question. But if we have a question somewhere that was asked a long time ago, is of extreme low quality and has never been answered, I almost don't want to show that question to Google at all. Just leave it out of the index. Don't link to it.
We already do call some of the older questions. Like a question with zero or particularly negative votes. A question has negative votes, we tend to call it pretty aggressively.
Okay.
If it has zero votes and it's not just getting any traction, like it's not getting votes, it's not getting views, it's not getting comments, certainly not getting answers.
Right.
Eventually we just delete it.
Right.
And we kind of delete it. It's like, okay, this isn't really helping anybody.
Right.
So we do have ways of doing that. But I guess to me, that's just like listening to the community. That's like, I mean, I guess you can't really listen to like the drive-by users that don't give you any feedback. You don't know, because, you know, some guy in, you know, I always pick Iowa. I feel bad because some guy in Iowa clicks on a server fault result.
Make it Ohio.
Ohio, sorry. Yeah, Ohio's much bigger, so it's, yeah. A guy in Ohio clicks on a server fault result and isn't happy. It's like, we don't really know why, but certainly just listening to our community, being on the metas and hearing like what are they seeing as problems, you know, quality problems is the big one.
Right.
Is really where I would rather focus. I mean, I don't mind looking at traffic. And certainly when you brought up Panda, like one thing that convinced me that it was the Panda update was that our buddies, the Hyphenated site, were complaining about this too. And they have a lot of sysadmin content.
They do.
So that sort of confirmed in my mind, okay, this is a real thing. This is like something that Google did with Panda definitely affected this genre of sites. So I'm
interesting. Yeah.
I'm fine with that. Like I believe that now. That's
well, true. They are. They must have a gigantic short click rate, because if people accidentally click on the Hyphenated Experts Exchange, it looks like a site that is trying to take money out of your pocket, because you don't see the answer, right? So they're going to click back and go try to find another site at an extremely high rate.
Well, actually, I think they would be the canary in the coal mine they're like kind of the most hated site on the internet by like pretty much most metrics. Look at. So like anything that Google does to eliminate hated sites,
right?
They would be your canary.
I wonder if server fault is getting dragged down a little bit by its association, because it has literally the same topic, right? Like something about the Bayesian algorithm is running and it's saying, oh yeah, we got to pull down Experts Exchange somehow. And that means sites that use the word Cisco or Novell a lot.
That in my mind really, really clarified that. Now, the other drop we're seeing on SuperUser, I'm not entirely convinced what that is. Because one thing I just replied to your Pro Web Insurance is one thing that is a relevant on SuperUser is it's a very young site. Like most of the users are like literally teenagers.
Oh.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not totally convinced of what's happening there, but I'm happy to publicize it, because I think this information that we're putting on Pro Webmasters, and as we learn about it, we share about it, that's sort of the principle of how we run the sites, is like, as we try to figure stuff out, we hope everybody can figure this stuff out. Because when you try to look at, like Joel is saying, like trying to figure this stuff out is, I mean, it's totally guessing. I mean, you can sort of invoke special privilege with Google if you have the poll, but
we try to avoid doing that.
Yeah, I really don't want to go be the person who's crying wolf. It's like every little time Google traffic changes, we have to go crying to our contacts at Google. I don't want to be that guy.
No.
But that said, I mean, if there's a problem, like if there's something wrong, like certainly when I wrote that blog entry, Trouble in the House of Google, I was like, this is wrong. Like, this is just not the way the world is supposed to be.
Right.
So I'm happy to provide that feedback to them. And like you said, it's kind of like the synergy of, well, we get 90% of our traffic from them. So on one hand, we're dependent on them. But on the other hand, we can giving them signals about like, okay, we think this is working. We think this is not working to make it better, not just for us, but for really everyone. Like, so other sysadmin sites may have gotten punished.
Right.
Which is kind of what we're saying. So that would be the thing that I would maybe be interested in looking at. But certainly, you know, go to Pro Webmasters. That's question 13920 if you have any data or you know, citations on maybe what's going on. Feel free to contribute there.
Cool. Let's get Josh on the line. There he is.
All right, I'm putting on my headphones.
Are you there? Are you with us, Josh?
Yes.
Ah, there he is.
Oh, he sounds good.
Sounds better now.
Sounds better?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I'll have to remember that about Skype Mobile.
That is silky smooth.
Skype Mobile is fine for phone calls, but not really quite for... How does it look, producer Alex? Okay, thumbs up. Josh is Shog 9. Did it used to be Shog to the 9th?
No. Oh, yeah. How did you know that?
I know that because there's about 15 years ago when we launched Stack Overflow, there was an article on another website, or there was a discussion on another website, which sort of filled the role of Stack Overflow before there was Stack Overflow. It was a code project? Is that a real site? Yes. And there was a discussion there, which I love. I have the URL like seared on my brain somewhere. Because it was a discussion, a bunch of code project people saying, well, Stack Overflow is launched. And there were a lot of people in that discussion saying, this is going nowhere. What a horrible user interface. That'll be gone within a week.
Joel does like referring to this. He cited it a couple times.
So. I love the, it's not really Schadenfreude. What is it? It's like the proving them right or whatever, or like laughing all the way to the bank, whichever way you want to put it. And you were a participant in that conversation,
right?
Probably.
Yeah.
Well, this is, and just to give we didn't actually introduce him technically.
Yes.
Josh, we hired Josh as a part-time community coordinator. And one of the reasons we did so is I think because of what Joel brought up is one of the things I liked about Josh was that he was there from the beginning, like just from the beginning, he was there sort of learning, doing stuff with us, giving feedback, just running sort of alongside us the whole way. And that's the way I like to run the part of the company that I can is that, you know, we're doing this stuff with you guys. We're doing it side by side in association with you. It's not, you know, us telling you what to do. It's we figure it out together. And I thought Josh was a very, very good example of this. But Josh, maybe you can explain, like, where did you used to hang out on you had a lot of community background. So you were on Code Project?
I started out on Usenet way, way back when I was asking all the stupid newbie questions and getting shouted down. And when I started Windows programming, I moved to Code Project because that's where all the answers were. And kind of got frustrated with the problems inherent in forums once they reach a certain traffic level. And that's about the time you launch Stack Overflow. So jumped on that.
Right. And
you have birds.
Yeah, it sounds very rustic there. Josh is in Colorado.
And how do you hear those birds?
We have awesome audio equipment here. It's just like totally, it's unbelievable. We got four laptops, two M Audio mobile pre-USBs, a headphone amplifier, and two Shure SM58 microphones.
There's
just
a lot
to
of crap
record
here.
One little podcast.
There's a whole lot of crap here, Josh.
So that's why we can hear the birds.
Sure. All right, well, I'm going to have to step inside then.
It's all right. The birds are very nice. I just want the audience to know that it's not like a sound effect we put on to try to make it sound charming.
Oh, no, I'm surrounded by nature.
Wow.
So, Josh, as far as what you do, I mean, I remember when I approached you, it was funny because you said, you'd be paying me to do what I'm already doing. Which is that you're just really avidly participating in the community, but I think it does change the tone. Like, I mean, in a good way. Like, we wanted to sort of empower you to sort of speak on our behalf in a sort of official capacity. I mean, I love that people come to our sites and are so engaged that they're like answering questions like better than I could. This is always a source of continual like amazement to me, and I'm very, very gratified that our community is so talented. But I think it is helpful to bless certain members of the community, saying, you know, these are official representatives, so that you can get sort of an official answer. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, having made the transition, like what the difference is between the way it was before and the way it is now?
Well, on the one hand, I no longer have to qualify my statements with, but I'm not an official Stack Overflow representative, and therefore you should take everything I say with a grain of salt. On the other hand, when I'm getting criticized for how things operate and for explaining how things operate, I can no longer say, hey, I don't control or I'm not involved with how this works. I'm just the messenger here. Don't shoot me.
Yeah.
So
it's the worst of both worlds is what you're saying.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. Well, that's just proof that we have to bring him on full time.
Yeah. Well, also, I think it gives you the not just the power to speak for the company, but the power to help change things. Like, if you really, like, for example, well, this does happen when you get hired. We implement your pet feature.
and
for Josh,
I should have had a better pet feature.
Feature. His pet feature was he was very concerned, and I think understandably so, that when we suspend people, there was sort of no indication like why they were suspended. It was just, okay, you've been suspended, which we, you know, time suspension.
Yeah.
But he had always maintained for a long time, like, this is what he called the Barbara Streisand. Can you explain it? Actually, I don't want to take your, well, maybe you should explain it.
The Barbara Streisand effect, apparently years and years ago, somebody posted pictures of Barbara Streisand's mansion on the internet, and she got all pissy about this, sued whoever published them to get them taken down, and the inevitable result was that everybody republished them everywhere. And people who have never cared
where Barbara Streisand lived
about seeing Barbara Streisand's house suddenly took an interest in it and reposted the photos on their blogs and stuff. So.
And that's actually pretty common. People try to cover things up, and the very act of the covering up becomes a big issue. That is even bigger than the original issue.
And I think that's what Josh was getting at. So go ahead and continue, Josh. I mean, granted,
well, so,
this...
So, you know, especially when this was first implemented, but it kind of kept happening on each new Stack Exchange site that rolled out. You'd get somebody suspended for something. You know, they'd fly off the handle about something, and you'd have to suspend to keep them from trashing the site and just let them cool down for a few days or whatever. And
well, actually, Josh, usually because I just...
Part of the community, so... Oh, go ahead.
It's just because I don't like them. That's the reason.
Oh, yeah. Or because you just didn't like them.
Don't say that, Producer Alex.
I'm joking. Well, my point is that's what people think. People think that we suspend just because we don't like people, which is like, I don't care.
No, but that's the standard Streisand effect thing kicking in, which is the minute you get you do something that you know is going to piss people off so that you get suspended. And then you say, oh, Jeff Atwood doesn't like me personally.
Yes. No, it's a personal vendetta. That's right. But continue, Josh. Sorry, I just wanted to make my stupid joke. So go ahead and continue.
Right. And so my idea was just that, okay, look, it doesn't help to drag all the gory details of this out in public. If you're involved in this, you already know what happened. If you weren't, you probably don't need to. I mean, that's the whole point of this, is to try and minimize the damage, let people cool down and get back to it. But if you don't say anything, I mean, you can be suspended for everything from, you know, just getting upset, trying to take your ball and go home, deciding you're going to delete everything you've ever posted on the site in one afternoon, all the way up to relentlessly spamming the site or creating 20 sock puppets and using them to increase your reputation. So people assume the worst. I mean, we had a top user on one of the sites get suspended, and immediately that was the accusations that came out was, okay, this is sock puppet voting. You know, he got to be the top user because he had this cadre of sock puppets who were upvoting him, and they found this out. And,
that's how Jeff Atwood got all this.
That's right.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, and this doesn't do anything useful. I mean, the guy can't comment on this. He's suspended.
Right.
The moderators aren't going to comment on it because, you know, whatever they say is going to be looked at with suspicion anyway. So you're kind of stuck. You have to shut down every discussion that crops up with people speculating on why this happened, and it just gets more and more poisonous as it drags on. So I thought, just summarize it. Just give us a rough idea of what happened, so, you know, when we see somebody who's been suspended, we come across this person who yesterday had 10,000 reputation, today has one, and can't post, and has a little red banner across the top saying this user is suspended until next week. Tell us what you know. How bad is this? Is this something where, okay, you know,
right,
had a bad day, and we can look forward to many useful contributions from you in the future, or yeah.
Raped a chambermaid in a luxury hotel in New York City.
That has to be removed from the podcast. Thanks, Joel.
Well, it's just jokes from the news.
Oh, that's great. Okay, well, let's get the R word in there. That's excellent. That's really going to improve.
Sexually assaulted a chambermaid.
Yes. See, Joel is now part of the problem. You see, this is why we have to have rules.
You know, on the Joel on Software Forum, we faced a similar issue and dealt with it in a much simpler way. This is sort of, Joel on Software is in some ways a very, very early prototype kind of Stack Overflow. Not really a prototype of Stack Overflow, but
inspiration
just sort of,
for.
Yeah, well, it was sort of where I started to get experience like managing sure. communities. And because of these things like the Streisand effect, the problem that you would have is that somebody would post garbage and you would delete it. And then they would turn it into a conversation about censorship. And they would instantly get everybody on their sides because, ooh, censorship is
who can be
bad.
For censorship, Joel?
Yeah, nobody's for censorship.
Nobody's for censorship. Yeah. I am. Oh, wait. Producer Alex is for
producer
censorship.
Alex is raising yeah. his hand. So the only way to deal with this that we found was to make it prohibited to talk about the site. And in fact, that's the origin of Meta, which is that on Joel on Software, we basically said, listen, you can't talk about the Joel on Software discussion group on Joel on Software because the main reason it's really boring, because every 3 weeks somebody new comes in and they immediately want to suggest all kinds of features for the forum. And the goal is not to talk about the forum, to talk about what you're talking about. That's just, it's just, a, you know, navel gazing. But, you know, combined with this was sort of, you know, if you get banned or if somebody gets censored or whatever, the moderators will just continue to delete all that stuff. And we had one additional step on the Joel on Software forum, which was surprisingly successful, which is that if you wrote something that got deleted, you would continue to see the things that you wrote that got deleted. So 90% of the users that were being censored did not know it, and that reduced 90% of the, oh my God, I've been censored, whiny crybaby posts by people who posted spam.
Right,
in the first place.
I'm really ambivalent about the hell ban. I need to write about that. I understand the rationale, and I think over time I've become like slightly more receptive to it because it does work.
It's not a total ban. It's just like the one thing that you posted that we decided to delete, and
but it's like the Truman Show. It's like you're in a fake reality. You've put somebody in a fake reality.
A
like,
little bit.
They don't know.
You're just trying to.
Right, I know, but for the good reasons. I understand, but it's just there's something about it that bothers me still.
It's not quite Manchurian Candidate. It's still just the Truman Show.
Yeah. Yeah. But that yeah, okay. But anyway, so this was Josh's suggestion. I think it ultimately was the correct suggestion. It just, you know, once Josh started, I couldn't really.
Right.
I the more I looked at it, I was like, well, you know, Josh is really right about this. And then Josh went in and rewrote the post to update it because in Josh's defense, like, the site has changed so much in a year and a half. Like, at that time, the type of suspensions we were talking about were really for, like, community hostile kind of behavior, either accidentally or intentional.
Right.
And now it's much more mundane. It's more like we suspend people typically because they're just producing a lot of really low quality stuff that they're basically littering.
Yeah.
And they may or may not realize it, but littering is still illegal, right? Doesn't matter yeah. if you know it's illegal or not. You're not supposed to do it.
Right, right.
So that's much more the tone of the suspensions. But I think it does help. And certainly we've all seen this train wreck thing of, you know, people, it almost becomes like once you have a problem situation, resolve it, there's a certain class of people that just want to what I like to call rubberneck. You
rubberneck.
Know, it's like
yes,
they're just
exactly
they just want to see carnage. They're like, oh, something bad happened. Let's
so
all go look.
So much more
look.
Exciting, and then they want to talk about it, and they want to make it into a personality fight.
Yeah,
and it has to be about the people.
Because it's entertaining, and I don't think again that they're trying to do this. I think it's more entertaining to see yeah. you know accidents happen and deal with them and
well,
look.
Well, they
at them.
Shut down gore.com. Where are you supposed to go?
I don't know that site, and I'm kind of happy I don't. But that's sort of where we're going with this is, you know, that was Josh's suggestion to actually show a reason, and now we do. And I think it does help diffuse a lot of potential mm-hmm. problems.
Okay. What else is on our list of agenda?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the CDN stuff that we're doing.
CDN. That's right. You posted about that today.
Yeah. On blog.stackexchange. This is something that Joel has been suggesting for a while, and I didn't resist it. It's a good idea, fundamentally.
I've been suggesting this? I think this is going to be another one of those things that I get credit for that I just cannot remember doing.
Well, we've looked at it for a while, so we've done a number of things. This is sort of this is the last low hanging fruit for performance for us, because we've done a lot of stuff over the last 3 years to make it, you know, sort of best practices of, you know, how do you make a website fast?
Yeah.
How do you make a website scale and things like that? And this is sort of the last remaining piece. This idea that, okay, our data center is in New York City. So whenever you make a request to any Stack Exchange site, you know, your packets, your intertubes have to connect from where you are to New York City. This is unavoidable, right? Mm-hmm. This is how you get data from us. But there's a whole class of files that we serve that aren't really changing that rapidly, like the JavaScript, the CSS, the images. These don't necessarily have to come from us. They could come from some sort of proxy that's much more worldwide. And that, in a nutshell, is what a content distribution network is designed to do.
Right.
Take the stuff that's not as essential, that's not changing every day, and put it on 20 servers all over the world that are much closer to people.
So a good content distribution network would have some kind of hacked up DNS system.
Yeah.
So that when you try to go to their DNS address, you're actually going to get an IP address, a different IP address based on where you are on the internet, network topology wise. If you're in, you know, Ouagadougou in what's it called?
No, Upper Ohio. Washington,
Burkina Faso.
We're doing
or Ohio.
We're in Ohio.
Yes. In Ohio, God forbid. Then you'll get an IP address that's somewhere, yeah, in Ohio, where there's a machine that has a cache that will either serve you a copy or go get for you a copy of the latest version of the file. And it's supposed to be totally transparent. You just sort of change around some URLs.
We've been doing some testing. You can go to the blog, and it's still, I mean, we're still accepting results. So if you want to help us test and just play with it, we also show you how to record this in your browser. But Joel's absolutely right that the DNS is a key part of this, because it has to figure out like where you are.
Yeah.
And connect you with the server that is appropriate for you.
So that's essentially the magic stuff that the content distribution networks have.
Mm-hmm. And also, since it's static content, they can be pretty fast. You know, it's not a lot of CPU time. It's just take this file, serve it. Mm-hmm. No processing, no thinking
right.
involved. Because we set up a what we call a ghetto CDN at sstatic.net. And that was mostly just, it wasn't really a content distribution network in the sense that it was still in our data center. It's not like you're getting some magical new data center. But it did help for performance, because you sort of remove all the CPU and processing time overhead of like, do I have to process code? Do I have to think about what I'm serving? Do I have to customize it for the user? This is Joel's page, you know.
Was that IIS, or was that running on some kind of?
That's actually just IIS, but we saw actually a really big performance benefit from that.
I think there are a lot of things you can turn off that a normal web server would be doing.
Yes.
You don't need to do it if you're just serving a handful of static files.
I mean, we could technically use, you know, Nginx or anything Node, to serve this. We could use anything, because these are just literally
strip out. You don't have to serve a lot of the headers that you would normally serve.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I know it sounds a little bit like a micro optimization. There were some people on the team that were like, should we even do this? This sounds like a waste of time. And I was like, no, we got to do this, because it's silly that all these files are going through the .NET pipeline, which they were.
Right.
And once we did it, we saw a surprisingly large performance benefit. So,
the thing is, if they're in a .NET pipeline with a lot of other actual .NET code that's running,
they clutter up the pipeline.
Latency, in other words, they might be waiting for something that is a long, lengthy process to happen, whereas serving a static file, there's nothing to wait for.
I would say anybody, even like a medium-sized site or even small, it's really worth doing this. Taking your static content and just breaking it, serving it from another server that's like optimized for doing...
Oh, there's another reason you want to serve it from another server, which is that the web browsers will only open a connection to, I think, two servers at a time.
I don't think that's
not so true anymore.
Not so true. I mean, there's some theory of like how many domains is optimal. You know what I mean? Like five domains, three domains, two domains.
Well, the theory was that a web browser, certainly in the old days, they used to say the web browser will open up to two connections per domain and up to four connections total, and that's all it'll open. So if you have a website that's serving a whole bunch of different images and they're all coming from the same site, it's going to have to do them one after the other. And if half of them are coming from site A and half of them are coming from site B, it can do them, you know.
I would look up like the current thinking on that, because browsers have evolved. But there is something to that. I mean, there's some like magical number that's better.
Right.
So definitely move to even if you don't have a CDN, just move all your static content to another server. That makes sense. And then what we're doing, which is certainly more expensive because you're, you know, working with a third party that has servers all over the world, is then take those files and put them on this CDN network of, you know, 30 servers across the world. And we're seeing very, very good results. Like even for me, because the servers, you know, I was ambivalent about this move to New York because I'm in California.
Yeah.
But I was open to it because it really did improve stuff for our European visitors, right?
Sure.
And that's a lot. We have a huge number of people from Europe. So I figured out on the whole it was, you know, a break-even sort of scenario. But now it's much better for me because everybody has nodes in California. I mean, it's usually East Coast, West Coast, and then something in the center. And I was seeing just for me personally, like getting one of our static JavaScript files was like one third the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really going to be, I think, a big win for everybody. And depending on where you are in the world, like for Sam in Australia, this is huge for him because he's got no good path.
Right.
It takes him like Australia 800 milliseconds to get a static file.
They must just be used to having slow internet or something down there.
Probably. You would think, it's interesting because you would think that like the sites that are local would do better because they have this huge advantage. I mean, unless it's like Facebook where they open, I assume Facebook opens regional data centers to do this stuff.
Yeah.
But unless you're as big as Facebook, like it would be so much faster.
You think
to
like
shop
the little
locally.
Australian sites would just be, would have an advantage over the big American sites.
Yeah. But I don't know if that's true or not, but you know, we'll see. So anyway, that's the CDN stuff. I'm really looking forward to that. Ben is in charge of that and doing a really great job on it. We're pretty far along. One thing we do worry about, Joel, that we've looked at, and I think we've resolved this concern, is we deploy a lot. We deploy at least one time a day, sometimes multiple times a day. And we don't want to worry, like, if we change some tiny thing in the JavaScript, that's a static file that has now changed. It needs to be changed on now not just one server, our New York server, but like 20 servers all over the world.
Yeah.
And sometimes some pretty, depending on your definition of bad, bad things can happen.
Well,
if the JavaScript is...
Let me see if I remember. I think that what Ben Kamens told me is that the best practice there, okay, now I'm attributing it to somebody and I'm going to get it wrong. But what I heard, there was one practice which said that all your static files should have a version number in them.
Well, we do that.
But the trouble is that then sometimes you forget to update the version number and bad things happen. So the latest best practice I heard is just to have a build script that generates a hash of the file itself and puts it in the file name.
I think that's what we do. I don't know if we use the hash of the file. I think we use the like check-in number, which for Mercurial is like a GUID.
Okay. Yeah. That would work.
Yeah. So it's the same, but even with that, even though we do that,
like
every time we make some major like JavaScript change, there's a certain class, it's a small percent of people, like they have proxies or something in the middle that just don't work.
Yeah.
So it will continue to serve them, even though the file has like a revision in it. Like, oh, don't care. Same. I'm going to give you this old file. Yeah, no, seriously. Every time this happens.
That's just a part of the weird way the world is. It's sort of like the keep alive. If you want to start to move things from one server to another, you can do something that most of the load balancers have something called drain stopping. So they'll start sending all new traffic to the server that you're going to keep up. And the server that's going down, it'll start to drain it out. And you can come back 3 days later, and there will still be clients connecting to that server asking for things from it because they've just been a web browser that's been open and it's been keep aliving for like 3 days.
Wow.
So at some point, you just give up and you say, you know, less than 1%.
I am surprised, you know, because our audience, although we're trying to broaden it, it is broadening. It's a lot of programmers, and I'm continually amazed with the number of programmers that will open something on Meta. And the number one is thinking, like, okay, did you clear your cache just to see? I mean, it's not like I asked you to reboot your computer, right? It's just
Control R or something.
Yeah, Control Shift F5 or whatever the heck it is. I mean, please, if you're listening, before contacting support on any website, just please clear your cache.
Yes.
Just in case.
Unplug your keyboard, blow a little bit at the contacts, and plug it back in.
Nintendo style. I think that can work. We also, another thing that happened with the latest version of Chrome, which is on, like, I think version 345 now, since probably incremented, like, while we were having this podcast, actually.
Yeah. And you never notice it too, because they like download it in the background and they upgrade it without telling you.
For the most part, yeah, it's very smooth. No, I like Chrome. Don't get me wrong, but it's frustrating because they do break stuff fairly often. And like Chrome 11, there was something about it that it didn't. If you had stuff, it didn't clear the cache. Like there was a lot of incidents. There was an unusual number of that.
Yeah.
Tied to the, and it was all people on Chrome.
Are you using the Chrome?
No. We don't support
the
scary. You know, I hate beta browsers so much.
Well, I mean, but it's supposed to be for developers so that they find out a little
bit in
advance.
Well, yeah, and we have a site for developers, and they love coming to Meta and saying, oh, I found this bug, and it's like, I'm on Chrome Dev Channel. I'm like, look, you know, we don't really... It's hard enough supporting the browsers that are out there without adding, like, random new dev versions to the mix, and I don't know why that isn't, like, immediately apparent to people, but that is certainly a fact that comes up, so... Just please, if you're going to report a bug on a website, just make sure you're on the current released version of the browser. Yeah. Just as a courtesy, that would be appreciated. So, but yeah, very very excited about the CDN stuff.
Cool.
What are the
results? Actually, I saw you're gathering data in a spreadsheet. There, is it too early to?
It's a little early, but
is there one of them that's coming out to be a lot better average performance?
Ben really likes NetDNA. NetDNA is doing really well in our tests. The only issue with NetDNA is they don't have their Asia servers online, which is kind of bad because that's a big chunk of what we're trying to fix. Yeah, particularly for Sam in Australia, they need those Asian servers to connect to. But even with that, they're still doing really well. So it's looking really good for NetDNA. Amazon, we have not been super impressed with.
Well, they don't have a – they're not – I mean, they're kind of like a content distribution network in that they have multiple data centers. But they weren't really engineered to be a content distribution network. They were just like, we're going to build a bunch of data centers. We might as well put them in four or five different places. Which is different than a real content distribution network would say, holy crap, the bandwidth to Australia is terrible. We definitely need something inside Australia. Whereas Amazon, I think, says, you know, if I'm building something, maybe I'll put one west, one east.
Right.
Like, I think they are a little bit less deliberate about the CDN strategy.
Yeah, and also, like, the invalidation thing we're looked at, because we deploy so much, we want a host that's guaranteeing really good invalidation, which Amazon is so on. But performance-wise, we weren't too impressed with Amazon. Those are the only two main findings so far. So NetDNA is doing really well. Amazon's doing not as good as expected. But that said, we're still testing. I mean, okay. We might add more to the mix. I don't know yet.
Yeah.
But the nice thing about this, Joel, and I was talking with Ben about this, is because it's totally a plug-and-play operation, if we decide we don't like NetDNA or whoever we go with, it doesn't matter, you can just rip them out and replace them, like, trivially, because that's the way CDNs work. They're designed to be on the edge, and you just have a variable that has, okay, this is the CDN, and it just sort of magically works.
Yeah, there's not that much. It's not that hard to roll out. I mean, these things were designed, you know, in the early 90s or mid-90s for, you know, the webmaster of CNN.com.
Well, I will say that, you know, I agree with you. It's a known science, but it's only in the last few years, I think, that there's been enough competition. A lot of the big CDNs were very expensive.
Akamai was, of course, the famous one. It's ridiculously expensive and had no competition for a long time because I think they claimed to have all kinds of patents on the DNS trick.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know what happened to that.
Interesting. I'll have to look that up. But yeah, for whatever reason, there wasn't a ton of competition. But now there's quite a few, like, you know, lower price rates. So if you have a medium-sized website, it's not crazy to entertain the idea that you would, you know, go to the CDN.
Right.
Of course, not an issue for us because we have, you know, unicorn dollars.
Unicorn
dollars. One thing I did want to mention is we did have a logo contest that we started on behalf of Lucene.net, which is now powering all of our search. And we do like it. I think the programmability of it has been really helpful because we can sort of tweak it to do exactly what we want, mostly. I mean, it's never going to be perfect. I don't want to give people this illusion of, you know, we're going to deliver Google-style results because that's kind of like the Holy Grail. I don't think we can really do that. But I do think it's gotten substantially better. It's very, very fast. It's getting better. It's continually getting better. I would say since we've launched search, I know we never really focused on it because we said, you know, okay, look, the UI for Stack Overflow and for Stack is kind of Google, right? Like, you type stuff into Google and you get, hopefully, on a Stack Exchange site.
And there are people using our search, though. Actually, this, I brought this up
because search is good.
Because my sister complained that there was something that she used to be able to go to all the time, which our search was not finding because it had a. It did have a lot of votes. It was sort of an awesome canonical question. But our search wasn't ranking it based on anything, really, votes. Basically, the Lucene – our search engine doesn't even use the signals that we have to rank. It just uses –
I mean, there's a tab for that. But in our defense, I did look at this one, and I think that particular word, for whatever reason that she used, just doesn't – That, in fact, what I suggested, and I was about to actually segue into this, one of the things that I really like about having an operation the size of Stack Exchange now is I feel like I've created an internet I can edit, which is awesome. Like, whenever I go, like, whenever I have a computer problem or, like, a programming problem, I can get really good results on our own sites now, like, most of the time.
Yeah.
So what I do is I go in, and if it's not quite as good as I think it should be, I just go edit it and make it more awesome. Right. I'm like, this should be more awesome so that, you know, because I want to find... really something really good.
Hopefully you're not the only person doing that.
No. I think a number of people are. And, you know, when I have a problem, it's the same basic theory. It's like, I want to create a page that's on one of our sites because I just feel like I can do a better job in creating something useful than like 80% of what's on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exciting. But so in this particular case, what I actually would recommend is the results that weren't quite right because there was this word. I don't remember the word. I'd have to go look it up. But it wasn't a word that was typically used. This is an iPhone question.
Yeah, it was something about how to get a beta, how to deploy a beta application to your iPhone.
And there was some magical word she used, which...
UDID, maybe?
I don't remember. Yeah. But not enough of our stuff had it. So what I would recommend is making sure that word appeared.
Oh, okay.
Like editing it to make more of a few of those.
So you think this is just a fluke? It wasn't really...
I mean, it could be. I mean, what Joel is saying is not wrong. Joel is saying our default search result page is purely relevance. Like, how strongly do we feel the words that you entered... Right. Match the post.
Which is really a pre-Google kind of search algorithm, right?
Kind of.
Yeah, it's a very, like, how many times the word appears? That just sounds like AltaVista, right? Like, oh, here's a page that says rental car 200 times. I'm putting this first.
Right. Well, it's not that. It's a little more sophisticated than that, but yes, I mean, it has the yeah. limitations. So I'm not averse to putting in some mild signals.
Better signals, yeah.
Because we have a votes tab. Like, you can do a search and then click votes, and you'll get the highest voted things that contain the word.
Yeah.
But we could have more of a hybrid where the relevance tab does factor in some of the voting.
Right.
To a limited degree. So I'm open to that. We can certainly... And I think this is filed under the category of continuing to improve
sure.
our search.
Which we always are.
Yeah, and another search thing that just went out, Joel, actually, is when you're asking a question now, we actually, the way this works is we match on title. We've done this forever since the beginning. In fact, Joel, I remember Joel's story of, like, I knew Stack Overflow was working because I went to ask a regex question. I typed in my title,
yeah.
hit tab, and then the question.
Yeah, already had the question.
Right, that was purely a title match, which is kind of a little bit brain damage, actually. But it works in some cases, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with
doing it.
People
do make a pretty strong effort on Stack Overflow to use good titles.
Some users do.
Yeah.
I appreciate those that do. So in addition to that, now what we do is, as you're typing the post, so you've entered a title, you got your title matches, you start typing your post in the body of the question, we dynamically show matches on the side now. Mm-hmm. We sort of replace some of the formatting help, because our formatting help got so much better as far as the little question mark that I was comfortable sort of replacing that with matches of, like, other questions that sort of are similar to what you just typed in, both in the body and the title. So that's another way we're leveraging
right.
the Lucene stuff.
Sure. Yeah.
That would have been, because it's still kind of expensive. I mean, search isn't free, but we can tweak it so heavily that we can incorporate it into our pipeline in a bunch of places
yeah.
without being so beholden to the old SQL Server full text way we were doing
that. That reminds me of something else we were talking about earlier, trying to get feedback from the drive-by internet users, what we refer to as drive-by users, who aren't members of the site. We could actually ask them maybe towards the bottom of the page or with a little pop-up, like, did this answer your question or not? I don't know why.
We could. I mean, what some sites do is, like, did this help you? You know? I don't know. I mean,
one possibility is that they then click no, and you give them a list of other things that our search engine found that might be more relevant.
Well, it
I don't
should.
Know why you do this? But
well, they should be seeing the related questions in the sidebar. I don't know. I mean, I'm always open to improving the experience in various ways.
Right.
We'd have to think about this a little bit more. But one thing we definitely don't capture is, you know, to interact with our site, you pretty much need a minimum of, like, 15, a certain rep, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
With zero rep, what can you do? You can ask a question. You can answer a question.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the core of any Q&A system. That's fine. But you cannot vote.
Yeah. Comment.
Comment. So really, you know, other than incrementing the view counter, which we talked about, that does factor into some things that we look at. You as a new user, how can you really influence the content on the site without getting rep? And the answer is you really can't. So what Joel is proposing, and I'm not initially against it, I would have to think about it a little bit more, is some way for anonymous users to sort of register some sort of, you know, did this work? Did this not work? Do I have the same problem comes
right,
up a lot, right?
Right. Right. That actually might, I mean, that might just be something that we put on 1 out of 100, you know, Google visitors to just track internally, like, how good a job are we doing at answering people's questions? I mean, I guess we'd have to have something that we wanted to change to compare that to. But
yeah. Well, we are a little bit exclusionary in the sense that you can't vote. I mean, voting is something we reserve for citizens, and
right.
that's the main way to influence the content.
That's in, not Battlefield. What's the Robert Heinlein one? They made it into a movie with the
Battlefield box. Earth?
Not Battlefield Earth, the good one.
The good one. Which one? Starship Troopers?
Starship Troopers.
The good one, not Battleship Troopers.
In Starship Troopers, military service guaranteed citizenship. That was the rule. You had to be willing, and this is Robert Heinlein's crazy moral philosophy, if you are not willing to die for your country, then you don't deserve to vote. And essentially, you don't get citizenship. You can live your life, but unless you've been in the military, you haven't shown that you care about something greater than yourself, and you can't be trusted with the power of the voting.
I kind of like that, actually.
Well, then we should do the first time you answer, you have to answer a question. Let's just do that. You have to answer a question and your voting privileges go on.
Well, there's a lot of game theory stuff we have to think about.
That's true. We could break the game. Never mind.
Yeah.
We have to think about that harder.
Yeah, we need to think about this a little bit harder. I'm not averse to having, like, another dimension, like, that's not really used as signal. You know what I mean? It's just sort of a number that shows. Because view count, like, one of the things I do have people approaching me saying, like, why do you show view counts? Like, who cares? Who cares how many views they are?
Oh, boy.
And I say, well, views are for the people who can't speak. These are the people who arrived at this page somehow. Yeah. Yeah. They didn't accidentally get to some random page on
They got there because it was linked from Hacker News because it was good.
Or like they found it through a web search, right?
Right.
So these are this is the voice for people who can't otherwise speak. So when I see something that has 10,000 views, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That means that this is getting found. Like this is useful to someone somewhere.
Yeah.
And we should spend more time improving this area of the site than say the question that has 10 views over a year.
What I want to figure out how to do is get rid of those onesie questions that can only help one person. Here, Josh, maybe you can help us on this. Still with us?
Yep.
You know, there are these questions of the form, you know, Jeff calls it the I forgot a semicolon, you forgot a semicolon question, where somebody pastes like a page of
code.
The
other form of this is my web page doesn't work. Here's a link to my web page. Please make it work.
Right. Right. And there's a bunch of problems with these I don't even want to go into. But the truth is people do feel like they enjoy answering them. And we had John Skeet on the podcast last week. And, you know, he basically said, look, I feel like if I can solve this problem for you in 2 minutes and it would have taken you 2 hours, I've just saved 2 hours of time for you. And I'm happy to do that. That's my contribution to making the world better, to fixing the world.
I do want to interject real briefly, but Josh, I want to hear your opinion on this. But I got a little annoyed because I actually ended up on some random Stack Overflow question from a fairly low quality asker that had engaged John Skeet, and willingly, John Skeet signed up for this, I'm not saying. But I was like, look at the value of John Skeet's time versus the value of this really low-quality question.
But that's exactly the point, is you're taking a person that it takes them 3 hours to accomplish the simplest thing, and you're allowing John Skeet to solve their problem in 3 seconds.
But there are,
and you made 3 hours of time for the world for this guy to get stoned in his basement with his neighbor.
Well, exactly. I mean, my point is, like, John Skeet...
Whatever he's going to use his time for.
To mix some metaphors, John Skeet should be, like, curing cancer. Like, the fact that he's engaging with this user, I was mildly offended.
Maybe the user is an oncologist.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay.
Anyway, so yeah, I understand that philosophy, and I don't object to it. And for people that want to do that, more power to them.
Right.
You know, Godspeed.
But what I'm getting at, and what I want Josh to tell us what we should do is there a way we can detect and or notice these questions? So it's okay to answer them, but you know, they're not really a part of the permanent record. They don't have to show up in Google searches ever because they're never going to help anybody. They can be, you know, stashed in the attic somewhere. We don't really ever want anybody landing on one of these questions from a Google search because they're not going to find their answer.
Right. So Josh, what do you think?
Honestly, I think you need to track internal views.
If what's an internal
somebody
view?
If there's somebody searching for it on the site, if there's somebody coming to it, linking to it, because I mean this is the thing, you can't look at these questions except for the simplest ones where, you know, they found their semicolon, or oh, I forgot to turn my printer on and that's why it wasn't printing, or whatever. I mean, you can't tell when it's answered whether this is going to be useful to anyone else. You look at this and you think, well, this is such a trivial problem. This is so specific to one person who just could not find the documentation and realize that, you know, what he's doing was like the whole purpose of the library existing. But
but that's a real answer. That might help somebody. I'm really thinking about the – I think we know these when you see them. I think if you go to the homepage of Stack Overflow, you could find one right now where it's somebody saying, you know, I wrote this code and it doesn't work. And the answer is – or it's really the I forgot a semicolon where it's like so specific. It's not.
I think the resolution is trivial. I mean, that's really the key thing here. The resolution is like whenever I see these and it's like, oh, you know, you misspelled this variable name. I'm like,
right,
delete.
Right. It's you misspelled a variable name. It's not anything that anybody else can learn from.
Yeah. Well, and I just want to interject.
It's never going to match any keywords.
I want to interject. We do have a close reason for this, which is too localized. And I actually made a copy change to this yesterday, because the way the two localized close reason works, I don't have it on my screen, but I'm going to paraphrase, is, you know, this question is you know, too narrow in time, space, or locality to be useful. I added some additional text to that, which leads with, this question would not be helpful to future visitors.
This question is unlikely to ever help any future visitors.
That's because I realized we were saying that wrong the whole time. And once I did that, I went to the moderator dashboard. I like to clear flags on the weekend. And I noticed a lot more two localized flags, a lot more than I'd ever seen. Because before it was like super rare. It's like two localized was not, I know you were worried about this, but we really don't see those. But once I added that, I was surprised how many more I saw. So I think they get it. They're like, okay, this isn't really going to help anybody else. We don't want this here. So maybe it's an education issue. Like, look, if you see a question and you legitimately say, like, there's no way this is going to help anyone else to know that you misspelled a variable name.
Yeah.
Or you forgot a semicolon.
Yeah, close it as too localized.
Yeah.
Like, solve it and then close it as too localized. It's not, if you want to solve it, that's fine.
And ultimately, they kind of have to be deleted too, because.
Well, you know, this is one of those things where when the site started out, when you could close questions with one vote, these actually, too localized did get used that way. And once you have to have five people voting on it, you get this whole sympathy thing coming in where, oh, but I really don't want to hurt this guy's feelings. He's asking an honest question. And yeah, sure, it's really, really specific to what he's working on. Look, he posted half the code from his project into the question and he's really stuck. I can't in good conscience vote for that. I mean, maybe you pick not a real question or something else and it still gets closed, but too localized, it almost seems like a slap in the face at that point. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, you're right. Education. If you really maybe emphasize to people that, okay, this is acceptable when somebody's solving their problem by asking one question after another, where they paste the result of the previous question into the new question.
Right. That we've seen that a few times where people are just like they don't actually know how to program, so they ask the first question and then they get the answer from that and they say, okay, this doesn't really do what I want because. It's a bizarre form of using the internet to do your homework. But I don't think I never really, I mean, maybe I'm more of a just a classify rather than punish, which is if there was a way to keep, I mean, these questions don't bother me. They just, first of all, they don't deserve John Skeet's time. So I think they probably shouldn't have as much of a chance at the homepage as better questions. You know, they should, you know, come and go quickly. And secondly, maybe they don't stay around forever in the archive. Maybe they get, maybe there's a tag. Like, I know we don't like meta tags that mean things about the type of question. But, you know, I always thought, like, homework questions are fine. Just tag it homework.
Well, we do allow homework. I mean, that's one I've been on the fence with because that is kind of a meta tag, but I do think it conveys useful information about the question.
It's just a way to say, hey, yeah, you can answer this or not. I just want everybody to know this is a homework question. And if you don't approve of answering other people's homework problems or if you want to answer it in a different way that's more pedagogically sound like they do on the math sites where you sort of give the person a hint so that they can learn on their own, then you know, that's sort of your right, and we're kind of leaving it up to you.
And I think, too, I think it has to come down to education. I think we just have to have a policy about this, and we have to be clear about it, and people can identify it, and, you know, the community leaders can speak about it, they can teach the others, that it becomes part of the culture. Because I was thinking, you know, as I was getting to sleep on it tonight, I was thinking part of what we're doing is creating, like, a culture, you know, even across the Stack Exchange network, this culture of sort of how we approach Q&A. Like, even a little bit bigger than the topic. Like, for example, the WordPress site, where you can go to, there, how many WordPress sites are there? Millions, but none that have sort of our community philosophy of like we're creating public artifacts that matter, in, you know, air quote matter, and our value system is such that we don't want to spend time on these trivial things, not because we don't like you and because what you're doing is trivial, but because we're trying to build this glorious structure that's going to last for time.
Right. We're making this awesome resource for the internet.
And we invite you to come with us, but like, you know, we have to acknowledge, look, like that's not part of our mission, and we have to sort of filter it off. And maybe
for people, I mean, I don't think I would say the vast majority of people that use or interact with our site think that it serves the purpose of people who have questions are able to type them and get an answer. Like they think that that's the goal is that people with questions can type them and get an answer.
I think only from the outside. I think for the people that actually participate, they realize it's a little bit more than that.
Yeah. But I mean, it's a big leap to say, actually, you know, I show this to people all the time. I go, when I'm doing demos of Stack Overflow or when I'm trying to explain something to somebody, I'll go to the homepage and I'll pick something, you know, some random question that's, you know, actually not a, I try not to find a recent one. I try to find a reasonably hot one. So here's one that has 372 views. And I say, this question was asked once. It was answered six times. There are eight comments here and it was viewed 372 times. So the vast majority, 99% of the activity around this question, the people that interacted with this question just read it.
And also, when you mention that, I would also mention our view counter is very strict. So when you see something at 372, you can easily double that, like
we need
probably
to,
more.
I think you need to go in and do that, actually. Just go put a times two there. Just we're kind of underselling X2. The value of our question.
Well, we're just really strict about that. Like, we don't want to count. We don't want to double count. So we throw stuff on the table. So when you see a low view number, easily double it. Without any hesitation.
The site that was really, I mean, that was a part of the idea of Stack Overflow was like, you know, it's not here for you to ask your questions. From the beginning, we didn't want to have the big gigantic question on the homepage, like ask your question.
Well, sure. I mean, in the value system, like, don't create poll questions, don't create list of X.
Right.
You know, things that are actually answerable. Provide citations, like, back up what you're saying.
Right. Don't just randomly ask.
In some ways, like, the culture of what we're doing, and I think this gets down to the Stack Exchange 1.0 model, which was, you know, just, you know, write us a check, and then you magically stamp out a community. And I think, obviously, that didn't work. That's where we're on Stack Exchange 2.0. But this is working so well. And I, you know, in a way, I want to deprecate the fact that it's not really about the software. It's about the value system. It's about the culture that we're creating. And I've been really impressed, like, how well we've been able to create culture. You know, people that really get what we're doing and understand the mission. And again, like, that's why you would get rid of these I forgot a semicolon question. Not because we don't like you. Not because we want to be mean to you. But we're trying to do something a little bit bigger than that here. And if you could sort of get on boat with us and help us do this, that'd be awesome. So I think it's a cultural and education thing. But that said, the too localized is the correct reason. If anyone listening sees questions like that, and again, it's not personal. It's not that we don't like the question asker, but really look at too localized, particularly with the copy update I made to it, and think, would this question really help another human being on the planet at any point? I mean, what's your honest estimation of how helpful this is going to be to another person? And it could be like, for example, it can work out like if it's an error message.
Sure. Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah, those are great. Right. Yeah. But like, forgot a semicolon. How, I mean...
Right. There's so many that seem like, oh, it's just me having this one particular problem, and somebody else is going to have a bunch of the same keywords. Like, if there's any keywords in there that you can identify.
That ties
to
the solution.
Well, this goes back to something you said a couple weeks, Joel. If you can edit the question to have
make
the
it more
keywords,
general.
If you can turn something specific into something more general,
right.
At least something that's more easy to find.
That's true. That's one of the things... we talked about when the podcast wasn't underway, so let's say it again once for the benefit of the podcast, is the idea of a canonical question, and that is that you see a question on server fault saying, or on super user saying, I can't get onto the internet, what should I do? And that could be considered a complete waste of time, or you could go edit the question and change it to say, what are the best practice troubleshooting steps when you can't get onto the internet? And then the answer should be, here are the top 10 things you should check when you can't get on the internet. And now you've made a page that's going to be useful for – you've taken a page that – of a question that couldn't have even been answered at all, couldn't have even been beneficial to the one person that was asking it. And, you know, the answer was probably, you know, move the antenna, you know, 2 feet upstream. And you've turned it into a troubleshooting guide for getting on the internet that everybody's going to benefit from. Or, you know, whatever the case may be. So a lot of times you get these one-off problems, which are, you know, what's a list of things I should try when my code is having the following symptoms?
Right. That's true, and I don't disagree with any of that. But at some point it becomes like a duplicate closing contest. I mean,
after that you can close about a million questions based on once you write the canonical one, then you close a million questions. And I tried to do that a couple of times as examples on answers.onstartups.com just to sort of serve as genuine examples. One is I noticed that there were about 10 questions a day there with individual founders of companies describing in detail for pages and pages exactly their relationship with all their co-founders and saying, how should we split up the equity of this company?
Oh, right. The equity split.
Yeah. And everybody wanted to tell their personal story of this guy joined 3 weeks later and that guy dot, dot, dot. And nobody was asking the real question, which is like, how do you even go about, you know, how do you decide? How do you know, what should be the general rule that you can follow? And then if you have exceptions, then we can talk about the exceptions. But so I found the one that was most generic looking and just gave it an overkill answer, 3 pages, you know, explaining a system that you can follow, which you may or may not agree with me, but it is a sort of canonical system for how to divide up equity in hopes that this inspires some people to do the same thing.
Right. Yeah, that was a great answer. We'll definitely put that in the show notes. I enjoyed that one. A little bit long, but other than that, good.
That's what all my blog posts were like in the old days. They just go on and on.
Yeah.
All right. We're close to short running out of time. Anything else we want to?
I want to come slightly back to Lucene.net. I know we started talking about search, but I got distracted. But we are designing a logo for them.
Oh yeah.
There's a time limit on that. So please, if you have any designery skills or know somebody that can help, this is a free thing we're doing to support an open source project that we use. So do feel free to take a look and pitch in. I'll put that in the show notes.
Oh, didn't Kyle announce the grand server fault thingamajiggy? The server fault conference?
It might be only on Meta server fault.
Yeah, all right. Let's announce it here just in case. Basically, if you're from the server fault community and interested in the world's first server fault conference, there's a question on meta.serverfault 1518. Kyle is starting to organize that. It looks like what we're going to do is we're going to tack it on as another day to the two-day West Coast Stack Overflow conference.
Oh, cool.
So the Stack Overflow conference will be 2 days of Stack Overflow, and then there'll be another day of server faults, either at the beginning or the end, with server faulty type content.
Right. Cool.
So if you're at all even vaguely interested, please get involved in the discussion there. Help Kyle out. Help us pick topics, pick speakers, and so forth. And we'll put a conference on for you.
I want one titled, Have You Tried Rebooting It?
Have you tried rebooting it? Have you? We can have one for the Broadcom.
Yeah, it'll be like a session on Broadcom network adapters. It'll be like a door that opens to an alligator pit. We're making jokes because we've had really bad experiences with these Broadcom network hardware, like on multiple different machines.
Things that just should have worked.
It's Windows specific, probably. I will say that. I don't know that it's
nobody has other Windows.
Yeah, nobody has Windows. But man, that was that was bad. So I would support such a session if you were to propose one.
All right, Lucene. That's pretty much all the announcements. We don't really have a plan for next week yet, but we'll get some guests on.
Yep.
No, we won't have a guest next week. Oh, there's no podcast next week because it's the board meeting? Really? Okay. I guess we have the board meeting next week, so we might...
Have the board meeting be the podcast if you want the most boring podcast ever. I'm just kidding. No, I love our board. Our board is good.
Ultra secret, top notch. It's true. Our podcasts are better than our board meetings.
That's okay. No, the board meetings are good. It's just it's a different thing.
Yeah. Okay, Sam Seffern and Marco Arman are both lined up for future podcasts.
Ben Dumke had a really good suggestion. Yeah. We have a user on DIY, Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, he's on the list.
He's on the list? Okay, that's awesome.
This is my list.
Yeah, that's great. Because I do like to bring in people because, as Ben pointed out, he's from DIY and he has no interaction with the rest of the network. So it would be really interesting to hear.
Not be a programmer.
Yes, I know. Can you imagine someone that's not... Joel, can you even know?
I don't even know what that person would be like.
If you looked at this picture, you know he's not a programmer.
That could be good.
Okay.
Yeah. He knows DIY stuff, man. That's awesome.
Fun.
Very cool.
Looking forward to it. All right. Thanks very much. And we'll see you all next week.
Yep. See you next week.
No.
See you 2 weeks from now. All right. And thank you, Josh, for being on the show.
And then the music plays. Right. Thanks, Josh.
Bye.